Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and once again, it's my pleasure and privilege to present Mike Rupert, a former LAPD narcotics detective and the editor of the From the Wilderness newsletter. Mike has been very active in exposing the intelligence community connection to the drug traffic and has been a visitor on this program before. A number of interviews with Mike Rupert, either by himself or with other people, are available from Spitfire. Mike, welcome back once again to our airwaves.
Dave, it's always a pleasure.
One of the subjects that we've covered in the past is the Tyree suit. That's a suit brought by Bill Tyree. I'm going to ask the impossible, Mike, and even though we've spoken about that in numerous programs available from Spitfire, I'm going to ask you to sum that up as best you can and update us if there's any new information about that.
Well, that's impossible. Oh, just kidding. Basically, Bill Tyree is a former U.S. Army Green Beret troop who was involved in a series of missions in 75, 6, and 7 in Panama, wherein CIA was ordering Green Berets into Colombia to plant radio beacons so that planes full of cocaine could fly below radar and land undetected at Albrook Airfield in Panama. Present at the offloading of the airplanes were Manuel Noriega, Ed Wilson of CIA, working for Tom Clines and Ted Shackley, Michael Harari, Israeli Mossad, and a number of other spook figures who you and I are both familiar with. There were about 105 such flights. Bill Tyree later transferred to the 10th Special Forces Group at Fort Devens, Massachusetts, where in 78 he was participating in very intense domestic illegal blackmail surveillance operations designed to keep a lid on the drug trafficking. He grew tired of that, wanted out, expressed his dissatisfaction with the illegal activities. His wife, who was also in the Army, was keeping a diary. Elaine Tyree was murdered in early 79, and Bill was framed for it. He has now just celebrated 20 years in prison for a crime he didn't commit, and that was done to keep him quiet. Last fall, Bill Tyree, with his attorney Ray Coleman, filed a $63 million lawsuit against the CIA, George Bush, Bill Clinton, Massachusetts Governor Paul Cellucci, Massachusetts AG Scott Harshbarger, because he was prosecuted at the state level and there was CIA complicity with state officials who were still in power in Massachusetts, basically exposing the whole of the CIA drug dealing operations with very strong connections to Mena, Arkansas, and which draws a very clear lineage up through from the 70s up through the present day and through all of Iran-Contra, which has been pretty well documented.
Bill Clinton certainly appears to have had a role in the MENA traffic. Various critics differ as to how big that role was, and of course, North and George Bush centrally involved in Iran-Contra.
Absolutely, and you know, one of the things that just has to be admitted is that you know, many of the Democrats say, oh, he couldn't have, he was a governor, but there's a very strong paper trail showing the Rose Law Firm negotiating some very classified CIA contracts at MENA. Webb Hubble participating in that with several firms that were closely linked to the drug trade there. So that is a nonpartisan fact. So at any rate, the lawsuit was filed, I believe, last August or September. A number of parties, all the parties have been served. Most of the parties have responded. George Bush has not. The U.S. attorney in Boston has announced that he will represent the CIA in the suit. The suit is still alive.
Mm-hmm.
They haven't really begun the discovery process because George Bush hasn't responded, and my understanding as of talking to Bill Tyree last week is what they will do as the next step is to move for summary judgment against those people who haven't responded to their service yet. Which will kind of force the issue a little bit further, but the government is fighting a pitched delaying battle here. Documents are surfacing, not so much through the court process, but because the suit itself is drawing a lot of attention. Bill is being sent documents. I'm being sent documents. D. Caron Ferdinand, who you've had on your show before, you know, has received some documents, all of which are indicating that the suit is very strong and it's drawn some very strong attention in Washington.
By the way, as a parenthetical element, certainly not to the suit, but for the purposes of the present discussion, once again, Mike, I'm going to ask you to do something impossible. Veteran listeners to this program know who D. Caron Ferdinand is, and I want to emphatically recommend to listeners that they contact Spitfire if they don't already have it and get an interview done in which D. Mike and Ray Coleman, the attorney for Bill Tyree, are conference called, and it is quite a piece of work. If you could tell us about Dee and her father, Al Carone, and how that relates to the suit and to some of the activities that are peripheral to the suit, although not peripheral to history.
Well, I describe Al Carone as the missing link between CIA and organized crime. And in fact, that's exactly what he was. Al Carone was a son of the heart to Vito Genovese. He was also OSS during the Second World War. Very close friend throughout his life with Bill Casey, to the point where Bill Casey attended his grandson's, Dee's son's, christening when he was born in New York City. Dee was Al Carone, a detective first grade with NYPD, was also very close to Paulie Castellano, Sam Ciancana, Santos Traficante, all of whom Dee knew as uncle. Dee was the bagman for Oliver North, Bill Casey, and George Bush, and we have a mountain of evidence which has been growing since I first wrote about this in 94. Just really tying the ends very, very closely to establish a long and well-established relationship between CIA and the mob, and your experienced listeners, of course, will hearken back to Genovese and Luciano during the Second World War. So this is, you know, but this is hard documentary proof. Carone lost his stomach for the work, and we are beginning to suspect that there was a strong POW factor behind that, behind stuff that he learned in the late 80s about what we had done and were continuing to do to POWs. And he died of chemical toxicity of unknown etiology, which we call the CIA flu, in 1990. And all of his assets were wiped out, all of his records wiped out. Dee was virtually bankrupted. And she was stuck with all of his medical bills, and even Al Carone's New Mexico driver's license was erased. So I've been working on that case for a long time. Dee is a very close friend. And what we found out within the last year or two was that the diaries kept by Bill Tyree's wife, Elaine, when she was murdered, which were very incriminating to CIA, were actually kept in Al Carone's possession, and he was involved in retrieving those diaries as evidence after Elaine Tyree's murder. And this was a fact that was unknown to Tyree, Dee, or myself, or several other parties involved for quite a while, until people made a connection with the name Sandy. Al Carone had always talked about a guy named Sandy, and that was Bill Tyree's nickname, and none of us knew that until one day Carone's name was mentioned in a conversation with Tyree, and Tyree said, "Tell Dee that this is Sandy," and Dee went, "Well, I can't use the word, but you can imagine what it was."
Right.
And that's how the connections were made.
I would also point out that Al Carone's death is but one of a number of suspicious deaths of high-ranking military and intelligence people who have raised the alarm or have taken note of Operation Watchtower. That was the program to place the beacons, or Operation Orwell, the nickname for the surveillance operation that you alluded to. I would also note that among the many bases touched upon by Al Carone, and he had, as I like to say, more connections than a switchboard, appears to have been the assassination of President Kennedy, in which he figured in a number of different respects.
Indeed. Dee had mentioned for the first time publicly, I think it was on your show, as a matter of fact, it was on your show. She had spoken to me about it, and she had filed an affidavit in Tyree's lawsuit. There's a very strong video affidavit filed in the suit that her father, Al Carone, had delivered a cash payoff to Jack Ruby in Dallas on November 21st of 63, and had also been present at Love Field for the arrival of JFK with a rifle the day of the assassination, but couldn't get off a shot.
Mm-hmm. Now, so the suit is apparently, according to the latest developments, is generating alarm in Washington, and the Tyree's counsel, Barry Coleman, is going to apply for summary judgment, and that is where things stand at this time.
Basically, that's all I can say officially. There's a lot of movement, you know, with letters and phone calls being made, but as far as the courthouse is concerned, that's the latest developments, yeah.
All righty. Now, in your From the Wilderness newsletter, Mike, and remind me to give the information at the end about how people can contact you to subscribe to that, you've raised a number of interesting hypotheses concerning possible connections between the recent unsuccessful impeachment attempt against Bill Clinton and a number of different aspects of the drugs intelligence connection that you have spent so much time researching and fighting against. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about Kenneth Starr's role in concocting a rule exempting the CIA from reporting contacts with drug dealers in the early 80s.
Well, many of the developments in this whole scenario, David, are highly suspicious to me in their timing. You know, you wonder why things happen where and when. after the first hearings on Volume 1, where Maxine Waters did, at the time, an absolutely wonderful job of blasting CIA into smithereens, which the press didn't cover, shortly after that, about a week, she got a copy of a memorandum that was written between William French Smith, the Attorney General for Ronald Reagan, and Bill Casey. In that memorandum, and I think I can quote almost exactly, is the paragraph, "In view of the fine cooperation received by the DEA, no formal requirement for reporting narcotics violations has been included in this procedure. After a series of 6 months of negotiations between Justice and CIA, two things happened. First, all the CIA agents, assets, contractors were classified as non-employees legally. And then in the second part of this MOU, after 6 months of negotiations by the special staff of William French Smith, all requirements to report drug trafficking by all of these people were removed from the CIA. And this shows clear-cut premeditation. Well, we have since found out, and I'll tell you on what I base that, that Ken Starr had a hand in writing this. Ken Starr was a special assistant to William French Smith, and as described in Volume 2, it was the special assistant staff of Smith, which negotiated the deal with CIA. I have a source in Justice who said Ken Starr actually wrote it. I won't go that far myself, but I'm sure that he had a hand in the negotiations and the drafting.
So we can say that an anonymous source has alleged to you that Starr actually wrote it. He certainly was a member of the staff that drew it up.
If you look at the transcripts of his confirmation hearings for his appointment as independent counsel back in late 94, he talks about being the special assistant to William Fred Smith.
All right.
So he talks about that clearly. And I just saw a clip on MSNBC last week of Ken Starr when they were talking about possibly investigating him. That was back from the 80s, and it shows him walking virtually arm-in-arm and joking with Bill Casey.
That certainly is completely consistent with what we've seen so far. Now, in your From the Wilderness newsletter, you have also advanced an interesting hypothesis concerning the release of Volume 2 on the Internet of the CIA's internal report and some of the maneuvering around the impeachment process and even the circumstances surrounding the surfacing of the Gary Webb story in 1996. Once again, I realize that in that we've got approximately 15 minutes left in this interview, it's impossible to really do justice to the topic, but I wonder if I could ask you to give us a synoptic overview and to tie in those various aspects of your hypothetical analysis. Well, no, it's your analysis, your working hypothesis on the subject.
Right, and not only that, I will give you a test by which you can tell whether I'm right or not.
All righty.
First of all, Starr was appointed independent counsel in late 94. The prime source for the Gary Webb stories, and Gary has done a magnificent job with this, and I do not for the slightest moment think that Gary Webb had anything to do with this scenario. We all get used from time to time.
Sure.
But Coral Baca, who is the prime source to instigate the Gary Webb stories, is documented as being either a fiancé or secret wife or consort of Carlos Leder Rivas. Carlos Leder was one of the founders of the Medellin cartel who was imprisoned by George Bush and forced to testify against Manuel Noriega. Carlos Leder is now out of prison. And Carlos Leder does not like George Bush, and Coral Baca shows up with grand jury transcripts as documented in Gary Webb's book, which are very hard to get. You don't come by federal grand jury transcripts easily. That started the Gary Webb stories. Now, that's kind of surprised me, but, you know, I didn't think about it much one way or the other. But there was a marked escalation in events in the Gary Webb stories breaking and the way the timelines played out. Every time Ken Starr got more active, the Gary Webb story got more active. What finally convinced me that there was a relation between Volume 2 and the CIA drug hearings, now you have to remember, John Deutsch and George Tenet, the current DCI, are both Clinton appointees, and they work for Bill Clinton at his direction, was the fact that Volume 2, which is a total, not total, but it's a very serious confession by CIA, was released on the web October the 8th, 1 hour after Henry Hyde's Judiciary Committee voted to start the impeachment inquiry. It was released, declassified, by George Tenet, who is Bill Clinton's appointed director of CIA. And it is a virtual indictment. In other words, you can take Volume 2, if our system were working properly, and you could move for indictments or impeachments or certainly just trash all the Republicans involved in the Reagan-Bush years. you could send Oliver North to jail, you know, for all crimes on which the statute of limitations doesn't apply. It's totally damning. And I was listening one night to Mike Levine talking to you, as a matter of fact. And I think Mike was on the air saying, well, the Democrats are totally upset at the Republicans because the Democrats gave the Republicans a ride after the Kerry committee report.
By the way, this was on a live broadcast on the late night on the Pacifica station KPFK in Los Angeles.
Right. And I couldn't go to sleep that night because, you know, it was just turning in my mind. And then I realized that the quid pro quo here was that Bill Clinton was saying, if you take me out behind the impeachment, I will reassume the bully pulpit behind volume two here, and I will bring down all of the government because I've got nothing to lose. I'll expose all of the corruption behind the drug dealing. And you can take me down for MENA, but I'm going anyway with the basic message. And you know what? I'm absolutely convinced that I'm right on that for a couple of reasons. First of all, the loudest cheerleader in support of Bill Clinton was Maxine Waters, who I said wonderful things about, and I thought she was very brave and courageous, but she has been utterly silent since Volume 2 has come out. You haven't heard her cheerleading over the revelations in Volume 2 or demanding hearings, which still have to happen. And I believe that Bill Clinton got his deal and the Republicans caved in simply because they understood what he was going to do with Volume 2 if they took him out. And as proof to that, in the most recent issue of my newsletter, I have a little tracking system on my webpage that tells me who my visitors are. And on, I believe it was February 11th, the day before all of the opposition caved in the Senate, when the Senate was doing no other business, all 100 senators were jurors. I had four visitors to that article on my website from the U.S. Senate, and I published a little thing in my newsletter showing that the Senate was, you know, reading that story on my page. So if I'm right, then you will hear next to nothing from Democratic leadership or black leadership or Maxine Waters protesting about the revelations in Volume 2 or demanding hearings to get to the bottom of it. And if I'm wrong, then you will hear black leadership and Democratic leadership come out and say, let's get to the bottom of this outrageous report and find out why CIA has admitted to dealing with 58 known traffickers, but keeping six out of jail, using bank accounts established by Oliver North to launder drug money and everything else they talk about in Volume 2.
And, of course, Oliver North is a defendant in the Tyree suit.
Yes.
As is George Bush and Bill Clinton,
yes.
As are George Bush and Bill Clinton. Now, again, reviewing some of this, because my guess there, members of the audience are going, good Lord, now what did he say? we do have some time here. We got about 10 minutes left, or maybe let's figure 5 or 6 minutes left before we want to review the information about From the Wilderness. But now, again, briefly, the Webb-Baca-Lader connection, or the hypothesis in your opinion.
Well, Carlos Lader is no friend of George Bush.
Right.
At the end of the Contra War years, a number of high-level figures connected with the Medellin cartel were either killed or imprisoned, and that would include Ochoa and Escobar, who founded Medellin, along with Carlos Lader. That would also include Mara Ballesteros in Honduras and Manuel Noriega, ultimately, in Panama. All were affiliated with the Medellin cartel. The CIA and the agency under George Bush's leadership, direction, command, basically overthrew the Medellin cartel at the end of the 80s in favor of the Cali cartel, which was more businesslike in its approaches. Medellin was very powerful, but it was also very bloody. So Lader went to prison and was, virtually forced into a deal where he testified against Noriega after Operation Just Cause in 89. Lader got out within the last, I think, 2 years. Now, Coral Baca, according to a number of sources and to documents which I have in my possession, is clearly linked to Carlos Lader as a consort, a romantic involvement, fiancé. One law enforcement document I have says she may be secretly married to him.
All righty. Now, just for formal purposes, for the sake of this and the other stations that carry the program, I want to say that neither myself nor this station nor any of the stations that carry this program are in possession of such information. So I'll refer to those as allegations, and this is not in any way to dump on what you're saying, Mike. It's simply to keep our ducks in a row from a formal FCC standpoint.
That's fine. You know, I have the documents.
All righty. Well, no, I'm not doubting that at all. But since I don't and the station doesn't, that'll just that'll make management sleep better. If this information itself doesn't give them headaches or nightmares. So the surfacing of the... I wondered myself, and I've ruminated on the air, Mike, about why the Gary Webb story emerged at that time. There's certainly the Contra drug traffic has been well known going all the way back to the Kerry Committee report and before. There had been widespread speculation that that had been the genesis or had much to do with the genesis of the crack cocaine epidemic in inner cities. And this whole, that line of hypothesis and the story had sort of died. And particularly with the demise of the Christic Institute suit, that was it. All of a sudden it resurfaced, and you are of the opinion that that was not happenstance.
Absolutely, absolutely. I agree with Franklin Roosevelt, who said nothing happens in politics by mistake.
And then the release, almost exactly as Clinton was about to be impeached, or Henry Hyde was setting the wheels in motion, the release of Volume 2 by Clinton-appointed CIA people was not, in your opinion, an accident?
I mean, it was 1 hour apart. The vote took place in House Judiciary, you know, at, let's say, 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and Volume 2 was up on the web at 5 o'clock.
Uh-huh. And with Kenneth Starr's alleged role in, well, certainly his presence on William French Smith's staff that drew up that very incriminating document,
right,
that you alluded to.
Right.
Was it a memorandum?
Yes, it was. Well, this was a letter of transmittal between French Smith and Casey regarding a more lengthy memorandum of understanding. And this specifically addressed the issue of why CIA was no longer required to report drug trafficking by its agents.
It is your hypothesis that basically Volume 2 and the information coming out of the Gary Webb story served as a very effective deterrent, with the possibility that Ken Starr himself could wind up being the target of a legal investigation of enormous dimensions.
Absolutely, and I think it worked. But see, here's the problem with that, which I think benefits all of us poor people out here in the country who are not the political power players, is that Volume 2 is still on the table. And Volume 2 is not closed. The issue is not closed. It's still open for investigation and discussion until such time as the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence holds a hearing to look at the findings. And through my newsletter and my webpage for 3 months now at least, I've been waging a little campaign to get people to write to the House Intelligence Committee, call them, email them, and say, we want full and open hearings on Volume 2. These revelations are too damning. We want cameras there. We want a full witness list, and we want to know what you find out. And that has had an effect. I know that they've received more than 600 letters as a result of my newsletter and the webpage campaign. And that's having an effect on the chair of the House Intelligence Committee, Porter Goss, who is himself a retired CIA case officer.
Interesting. So this certainly presents a very fascinating possible relationship between a number of seemingly disparate events. I just thought of an interesting pun that I'm going to have to skirt gently because of the fact that we're on the air. Of course, Ken Starr was trying to nail Bill Clinton because of the BJs he got from Monica Lewinsky, and I can't say that on the air. As a former narcotics detective, you certainly know that one of the slang terms for cocaine is blow.
Yes.
And so perhaps a and job of an entirely different sort on Ken Starr's efforts, or as a result of Ken Starr's efforts, with a focus of Clinton's attempts at neutralizing Ken Starr's inquiry into the BJs that he got from Monica Lewinsky.
That's about, you know, that pretty much sums it up.
All righty. We've got a few more minutes. Do you think in maybe 60 or 90 seconds you could sum up the C-130 stories that you did in From the Wilderness?
Okay. Again, all this information is available on my website, and I'm going to sneak in that plug now.
Sure.
Which is at www.copvcia.com. CopVCIA. Think Roe v. Wade, but replace it with Cop Against the CIA.com. In December, I had a very lengthy story, detailed story, with thanks to some great investigative reporters and some wonderful sources, showing that CIA had, over a period of time, used the Forest Service, and Frank Church documented this very well, as a cover. And they moved more than 28 C-130 Hercules aircraft out of Department of Defense through the Forest Service, and then ostensibly to fight forest fires, into the hands of private air tanker contractors over a period of 8-10 years. The problem was that these C-130s, which wound up in private hands, were basically embezzled from the government, wound up in Kuwait, Iran, Iraq, Angola, South Africa, Israel, Egypt, Panama, Mexico, and many of them wound up in the drug trade, all with CIA protection and operation. They were doing anything but fighting forest fires. There's an active federal court case, well, actually, one was settled last year in which Roy Reagan, a spook connected with the Forest Service who embezzled these aircraft for the agency, is actually now serving prison time. He was caught. A guy named Fred Fox out of New Mexico was also sentenced behind this. One of these airplanes turned up with a company named Aeropostal de Mexico in Mexico City in very late 1996 with close to $1 billion worth of cocaine on board.
Only $1 billion?
Yeah, I mean a billion here and a billion there, as Dirksen used to say. And this resulted in an indictment in Chicago, and it traced directly back to a firm called T&G Air Freight in Arizona, which is very closely connected to Evergreen Air, and I have all of that documentation in the story, which was in my December newsletter. That was that's not on the website. That's for subscribers. But
and by the way, let me interject that Evergreen Air is appears to have been a CIA Air proprietary. Certainly heavily overlapped with some of the directorship of CIA Air proprietaries, and a subsidiary Evergreen Helicopter did the Malathion spraying here in the Bay Area in the early 1980s.
Evergreen is huge up here in the Bay Area. So was Southern Air Transport.
Uh-huh, and that is definitely a CIA Air proprietary.
No question about it.
And George Dooley, who was sort of the godfather of the CIA Air proprietaries, put those together. Mike, in the last minute here or so, review again for us the website address and also the mailing address, et cetera, post office box for From the Wilderness, your very fine newsletter. Bear in mind there'll be some people who'll be trying to scribble, so give us do it slowly and repeat it if you would.
Okay. The website address is www.copvcia.com, copvcia.com. The newsletter From the Wilderness, if you want information, you know, on the web, you can write to me, or From the Wilderness at Post Office Box 6061-350 in Sherman Oaks, California, 91413. That's 6061-350, Sherman Oaks 91413. And I'll get back to you. Of course, I'm traveling now. You know, I'm in Oakland right now at the moment, and I'm speaking tomorrow at a conference at Berkeley.
All righty, and we will give that information once the formal part of the broadcast is concluded here, because this obviously is going to be in syndication for stations that will be getting this long after that and are out of the geographical area. One more time, website, mailing address, etc., for people who want to contact you about From the Wilderness or visit your website.
www.copvcia.com. Think of Roe v. Wade, but change it to a cop versus the Central Intelligence Agency. Or write to me, or write to From the Wilderness at Post Office Box 6061-350 in Sherman Oaks, California, 91413.
And you have an email, because many people in the Silicon Valley and elsewhere like to use email.
Oh, boy, do I know that. The email is mrupert, R-U-2-P's, E-R-T, R-U-P-P-E-R-T, at copvcia.com. And Rupert at copvcia.com. Now, I'm getting about 60 emails a day, and I've been away from L.A. now for a few days, so it's going to be busy, but I will get back to anyone who sends me an email.
Well, Mike, I also wanted to stress in the closing seconds here that you also have been getting death threats, as have members of your family, and this is indicative of the load that you've decided to shoulder and the bravery that you've demonstrated in following this story. And on behalf of the people who are listening to this program, I want to thank you for your efforts.
David, thank you. Thank you so very much, and it's always good to be with you. You understand so well what you're talking about. You make it very easy.
All righty. Well, thanks for the kind words, Mike. For Mike Rupert, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.